Insurance professionals work hard every day to keep people safe. But as technology transforms the industry, how can insurers protect not only their clients, but also shield themselves from ever-changing cyber risks? My name's Elizabeth Blossfield, and I'm the host of the Insuring Cyber Podcast, a bi-monthly look into how the world of cyber and the business of insurance are connected. In the last podcast episode, we discussed cyber risks businesses and individuals are facing because of the remote work environment brought on in part by the pandemic. In this episode, we're talking about one area of cyber risk that can easily go hand in hand with working from home: social engineering risk. It's a term that has come up a lot on this podcast, so on this episode, I decided to connect with a couple of experts to learn more about what it means and how it's affecting businesses and their cyber insurers. Social engineering cyber attacks rely on human error, which is why experts say businesses need to be extra cautious about training and awareness. Through psychological manipulation, social engineering techniques trick a user into providing compromising information about an organization or access to its computer systems. A common form of this type of attack is phishing, in which email is typically used to solicit personal information by pretending to come from a trustworthy sender. I decided to call Aaron Kennealy, the head of cyber risk analytics for Guidewire, a technology provider to the property and casualty insurance industry. Aaron has a background in cybersecurity, formerly serving as a U.S. Department of Homeland Security analyst in its cybersecurity division. She spoke with me about the various types of social engineering attacks that are currently being used and the challenges that exist regarding insurance coverage for this type of attack. Here's our conversation. Hey, Aaron, it's great to be speaking with you. How are you doing?
I'm well. Thanks, Elizabeth.
Yeah, of course. So I know I've heard a lot about social engineering attacks and how they're becoming more of a concern, but could you just start off by explaining what social engineering attacks involve and why individuals and businesses should be cautious of them?
Sure. Yeah, so to put it simply, it's really they're really about exploiting human psychology. So in the context of information security and cyber insurance for perils that result from failures in information security, social engineering is really psychological manipulation of people to get them to perform acts or to divulge confidential information. So the cyber attack techniques, they involve mostly email and social media in the form of what's called phishing, baiting, online scams. Really at the heart of most of the social engineering is this notion of impersonation. So this is when, a digital adversary poses as an authoritative and legitimate entity. So think trusted third parties like a supplier or contractor or a vendor. Also trusted entities like fellow employees or authorities within a company or a trusted brand. And then sometimes it can occur by compromising a legitimate email account of one of these trusted parties. And these are especially pernicious because the emails is actually coming from a legitimate sender versus like a spoofed email account. And it's just that the little legitimate person is not directing it. So to your question about why social engineering should be of concern to businesses and individuals, look, it's been a regular leading source of loss for businesses from, small nonprofits to large and sophisticated enterprises and across pretty much all revenue bands. In particular, the most common social engineering attacks are phishing and business email compromises. There's no shortage of stats around kind of the leading social engineering attacks. So Verizon puts out a data breach investigations report that's pretty well served. And what they said in their 2020 report was 22% of data breaches stem from phishing. 75% of companies in a survey reported that they were being phished, and then 96% of those are arriving by email versus, a small percent carried out through malicious websites. Since I'd say 2016, phishing really has replaced malware as a leading type of kind of unsafe website. While there was once, you know, I think twice as many malware sites as phishing sites on the web, there's now about 75 times as many phishing sites as there are malware sites, right? So Google has registered over 2 million of these phishing sites alone. The other stat I would just point out is from another leading source of social engineering attacks and cost to companies, which is the FBI. And they put out this IC3 report, which is Internet Crime and Complaint Center. So they collect information from compromised individuals and companies across the year. So their 2020 IC3 crime report, they disclosed receiving over 19,000 BEC. So that's business email compromise. That's another version of social engineering attacks. They received over 19,000 complaints for BEC, and they estimated kind of adjusted losses to be over $1.8 billion. So yeah, it's pretty serious, and you know, the losses are greater than what we've seen from ransomware. So folks are rightfully concerned about it.
Great. Yeah, thanks for that explanation. And, you know, I find this interesting because a lot of companies seem to be increasingly focused on making sure their software is protected from any vulnerabilities. But like you said, social engineering attacks rely on human error. So with that in mind, what can companies be doing to make sure they're protected from this kind of attack? And how can they be working with their employees to better train them?
Sure. Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, unfortunately, everyone wants a silver bullet here. But the reality is the best protection is training and awareness. You're seeing a lot of companies implementing mandatory training, which is very important. Now, you can also imagine, as I'm sure many of the listeners can sympathize with, there's a lot of resistance to watching online training, and people are trying to sort of avoid having to do that. I will say, having gone through many of them myself, there's been some advances to kind of make them more engaging and entertaining, while simultaneously, you know, teaching folks the behavior, the knowledge, and the skills that they need. So, you know, using things like animations or scenarios, or, you know, kind of choose your own adventure kind of simulations makes it, you know, palatable, as it were. You know, these classic training, again, there's no rocket science here. The traditional messaging is things like don't open emails or click on attachments or links from untrusted sources. If you get a message from someone purporting to be, you know, a friend, colleague, or family member, and it looks suspicious, you know, don't open it, contact them offline. Don't, you know, give offers from strangers the benefit of the doubt, right? The age old rule, if it seems too good to be true, it probably is. There's also some technical controls that can augment the human awareness training. So things like multi-factor authentication for employee access to, you know, applications that access sensitive data or internal systems, right? Because oftentimes what these fraudsters will do is, you know, they're trying to get your credentials to get access into internal company systems. And so if there's MFA in place, just having a username password won't work. There's also anti-phishing technology such as anti-spam and anti-malware. A lot of companies are using email content and URL filtering at their gateway. So, you know, sometimes you'll see that you'll get a message, like, let's say you use Mimecast, and they'll list some email messages that, you know, that they may detect as being spam, and then you can go permit them or deny them. And then things like email authentication mechanisms, which is one of the things that we detect for, which is to say there's, you know, this is acronym soup, but there's authentication mechanisms called SPF, DMARC, and DKIM. And essentially what they do is they help protect the company against email spoofing. And so that's another technical control that can help augment against this risk.
Okay, great. Yeah, and you mentioned phishing and business email compromise earlier. Can you talk more about the most common types of social engineering attacks and what companies need to be looking out for? You sort of touched on this already.
Sure, yeah. You know, there's no kind of single classification authoritatively, but you can kind of break down the main types of social engineering into phishing, baiting, pretexting and business email compromise. And frankly, they're all sort of different species of the same genus, which is this social engineering. So phishing, you know, that's dominated the global cybercrime arena. The goals here are basically obtain sensitive information from somebody, you know, in a company or an individual. Oftentimes, phishing emails will include like shortened or misleading links that would then redirect the recipient of that email to a suspicious website that then hosts a phishing landing page. It also can involve email attachments that would be laced with malware. So if a user clicks on that attachment, it will execute an exploit on the user system and they'll be compromised. The other thing is the point to note here with phishing is, for the most part, from like a psychological perspective, often they involve threats and trying to instill a sense of fear or a sense of urgency in an attempt to sort of manipulate users into responding quickly. People sort of forget because we have come a pretty far way, I should say, in terms of user awareness and technical augmentation. But, you know, two of the biggest grossing cyber attacks ever, back in 2004 and 2003. So MyDoom was in 2004 and it cost estimated $38 billion. And it was responsible for 25% of all emails, I should say, at the time. And what it was an email attachment worm that masqueraded as legitimate software. And then the other one was so big, and that was a $30 million endeavor as well. So that's phishing. Baiting basically can occur via email or online social media. So what this does, again, it's very similar, but it promises a benefit, whether that be a good or a service, in exchange for a good or some type of information that then the malicious actor uses to entice the victims. So, for example, a baiter might leverage, I don't know, the offer of free music or discounts or some sort of, you know, upgrade in order to trick users into handing over their login credentials. So another variation would be pretexting. Now, this occurs when attackers create a pretext, right? So a fabricated scenario that they use to try and steal, again, confidential information. So what happens is the attacker scammer requests certain bits of information from the target in order to confirm their identity, and then they steal that data and use it to commit identity theft or stage like secondary attacks. A popular one here is someone might create a pretext as if they were an IT administrator claiming to need information to install new, you know, security tools or to harden their system or something like that. So as I mentioned, kind of to differentiate, the phishing attack mainly uses kind of fear and urgency to their advantage, whereas pretexting really kind of relies more on building a false sense of trust with the victim. And then the last one is BEC, business email compromise. This is, you know, I would say phishing is definitely the most prevalent. BEC is definitely the most costly. Now, this is the type of scam that targets companies who conduct wire transfers. So what happens here is the emails of like executives or corporate finance employees who are involved with wire transfer payments are spoofed or they're compromised, and then they're used to dupe employees into transferring large sums of money into fake accounts. The interesting thing here is, you know, BEC scams don't have any malicious links or attachments. So they can, you know, pretty much more easily evade technical counter social engineering measures that I mentioned before. There's a bunch of varieties of BEC. There's, you know, impersonating attorneys. There's CEO fraud. So attackers pose as a company CEO or an executive and send an email to the target employee in finance and request them to transfer money to a fraudulent account. An interesting kind of reversal is this invoice kind of manipulation, where hackers impersonate an organization and trick that organization's customers or their vendors into paying into a fraudulent account. So by the time the organization that was supposed to receive that invoice notices, you know, they've lost large sums of money. So yeah, that's kind of it in a nutshell.
Yeah, those are all really important things to be aware of. And one thing I was curious as well is, are you seeing a greater risk of these types of attacks that you just mentioned during the pandemic, since people are more, you know, comfortable working from home with their, you know, security protocols, or feel more comfortable on their own networks?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, getting back to the statistics, the IC3 2020 reported over a doubling of phishing complaints in the COVID year. So, you know, the bottom line here is, similar to how, you know, in the aftermath of any kind of natural disaster or major event, it really breeds scammers and fraudsters, right? They come out of the woodwork. And the COVID-19 crisis made good on this pattern of kind of calamities that attract these opportunistic cyber criminals. So the spear phishing and spam phishing species of phishing are known attack vectors for, you know, manipulation and system compromise. And pretty much every cybercrime stat that you'll see near unanimously will show a growth in both the phishing, the frequency of the attacks, as well as incidents themselves.
Yeah, that makes sense. And, you know, we've talked a lot so far about things to look out for in terms of these social engineering attacks. But on the insurance side, you know, I've heard that social engineering attacks are typically excluded from traditional crime fidelity insurance policies, and clients will need to purchase an endorsement to have this risk covered in some cases. So I was just curious, you know, how can clients be working with their brokers to make sure they have the right coverage for these social engineering risks?
Right. That's a great question. So a lot of people might not be aware of this. So despite the growth of cyber liability and data breach insurance today, many cyber insurance policies generally do not provide coverage for social engineering fraud. And this is could be a function of a couple things. For some, it's really just a matter of not having adopted new language to cover these losses yet. For some, it's a concern about risk selection and uncertainty about underwriting this risk. And frankly, for most, they still don't consider social engineering a cyber risk at all, right? So the coverage where social engineering risk is most often found, if it exists, is in the standalone crime insurance policies. And then sometimes you'll find it as part of a D&O insurance program. But, you know, importantly for listeners, the as-is policies here won't provide protection against social engineering. So what that means is you've got to have a separate endorsement. It's got to be deliberately added. And, you know, I would suggest rigorously examined in order to address the social engineering risk. Now, the traditional fidelity in the crime insurance policies, what they'll do is they'll limit losses owing to fraud schemes. So they're defining it kind of in two broad ways. Fraud schemes that, number one, the business has no knowledge of, and number two, that the business isn't an active participant in, right? So number two is the tricky part, and it's the basis for insurers denying coverage for social engineering claims under those crime or the fidelity policies. And the rationale is that there's no, from insurance perspective, that there's no, air quotes, direct fraud that has taken place. So the claim is that, you know, a hacker hasn't penetrated a company's systems and then effectuated the wiring of money to a fraudulent account, but rather the fraudulent transaction was actually given consent by a trusted employee. Now, albeit this is under false pretenses, but that's kind of how it's broken down. And so it argues for, you know, when you're reviewing the social engineering coverage, there's some gotchas, right? So be aware of policy clauses that really narrow or even nullify the coverage, such as ones that require direct fraud or would include air quotes, voluntary parting exclusion is the term of art there. Or ones that require the company to verify that all transfer requests are made prior to triggering coverage. Modalities are key as well. So I think insured entities want to make sure that the coverage is included for any social engineering attack, whether it be by phone or email or vis-a-vis electronic devices. I think it's in the company's best interest to make sure there's no exclusion for phishing attacks in that policy. As well, and this is the case with all policies, there's going to be sublimits, right? So make sure that you know what those sublimits are, and just be comfortable with those, what those limits are. And I think it's important to know that the language and definitions across insurers is not even close to being universal. So social engineering fraud might be labeled financial fraud loss. It might be labeled unwitting data breach. It could also be labeled business instruction fraud or wire fraud, which many people would be familiar with. And then I guess lastly, I would say, as with all policies, again, given the bear market for this type of coverage, it's smart to understand kind of the cost benefit equation and where you as a company seeking insurance might be better positioned to buy down that social engineering risk with security controls. Right. So if you as a company are concerned about IP theft owing to a social engineering attack, you're going to be out of luck from an insurance perspective, because carriers only provide coverage for tangible property. Right. They're not going to insure your intellectual property. So again, this is a place where you want to make sure that your security controls are in place to help mitigate.
Yeah, sure. That makes sense. And with the increase in these attacks during the pandemic, as well as the fact that cyber attacks are just growing in severity, do you expect that more insurers will step in to cover specific social engineering risks? And do you think there will be fewer challenges with the coverage around this risk in the future?
Yeah. So my take on this is, despite the huge gap between cyber crime and insurance, right? So there's been estimates that the yearly economic cost of cybercrime is, somewhere in the neighborhood of $700 billion, with only about $5 billion of that in insurance premiums. And the fact that, there's a projected growth in the cyber insurance market, those would both sort of argue for an expansion of coverage here. But I would contend that there's kind of two countervailing considerations that are forcing the cyber insurance market to harden. Number one is this looming threat of a cyber catastrophe or catastrophes, right? So due to risk accumulation, so these recent events like SolarWinds and the Microsoft Exchange incident have only kind of brought that closer to home. And the second countervailing consideration is the market rise in ransomware claims. So these have caused attritional threat to insurers' profitability. Their loss ratios are definitely climbing, and many of them have lost their profit buffers. So I think they're going to be reluctant to expand coverages in risky areas. So the bottom line is I don't really see carriers rushing to provide the coverage needed to address the quality and the quantity of risk on the ground for social engineering attacks in the near future.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. And Aaron, this has been a really interesting conversation, so thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
Thanks very much, Elizabeth.
According to Gallagher's 2021 U.S. Cyber Insight Report, throughout 2020 and into this year, increasingly sophisticated social engineering techniques have kept hackers one step ahead of their victims. John Farley, Gallagher's managing director of the U.S. Cyber Practice, developed the report that focuses on how organizations can prepare for increased cyber risk, as well as key areas of prevention and how cyber brokers can help clients address threats. I decided to speak with John to learn more about how brokers can be working with their clients to ensure coverage for social engineering risks, and why many organizations surveyed in the report said they still aren't feeling confident that cyber incidents involving the remote workforce will be covered by insurance. Here's what he had to say. Hi, John. It's great to be speaking with you. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on the podcast.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for taking the time. So I know that you developed Gallagher's 2021 U.S. Cyber Insight Report, which says that throughout last year and into this year, there have been increasingly sophisticated social engineering techniques being used by criminals. So could you just start off talking about how you've seen social engineering attacks becoming more advanced over the past year?
Sure, absolutely. You know, it was really interesting. You know, hackers have a way of pivoting really quickly and changing their tactics and techniques to exploit, you know, vulnerabilities. And this year, what we saw when the pandemic hit, what we had were sort of an almost immediate wave of social engineering emails that went out that were themed on COVID-19. So they would purport to be members of the CDC or the WHO, and they would have this information that we're all seeking on vaccines and treatment for COVID. And they really played on people's need for that information. And so people were clicking on links, you know, as these emails came in and attachments. And hackers really found a way to sort of leverage that need for information on that particular topic and really just play on our vulnerabilities there. And so social engineering was really ramped up with COVID-19 themed emails almost immediately in March last year. And they were pretty successful at it. You know, and there's other ways they've done it too. I mean, we saw, I'm not sure if you're familiar with SIM swapping. Have you heard of that technique?
I haven't, no. What's that about?
So SIM swapping is where a hacker impersonates someone and gets a phone provider to give them the SIM card for a phone, and they essentially steal the phone number of a victim. So they could either bribe someone at the phone company or they can social engineer the phone company employee. Either way, they take control of somebody's phone. Why is that scary? Well, when you change your password on your online banking, you know, they're gonna send you an email to say, hey, here's a code, use this code to change your password. Well, the hacker has that person's phone and is getting those texts, right? So they call that SIM swapping. And it's really, really concerning, because if you think about that, if you can take control of somebody's phone and the texts that are coming in, you can do a lot of harm with that. So that's sort of another way they sort of up their game.
Yeah, that's crazy. That SIM swapping sounds really scary. And, you know, like you said, I've heard that there can be an increased risk of these social engineering threats right now because of COVID. And so I was just curious, you know, in what ways are businesses and their employees needing to change their cyber incident preparation and response plans, you know, to prepare for these types of social engineering attacks during the pandemic?
Right. So, I mean, first and most, I mean, employees are really now just working remote, right? They don't have people just down the hallway from them. They don't have someone that they typically converse with. They're kind of on their own. So that kind of leads to a couple of problems. Like, first of all, I mean, when you know, where do we escalate, you know, issues, right? Do you necessarily know who to talk to if you see something happen, or phishing email coming in, or something that concerns you from a cybersecurity perspective? So the sheer isolation of people, you know, prevents a lot of communication, or impedes it at least. And so that's sort of one issue, the escalation issue and the communication that's just not happening as much. But, you know, there's also, we're relying now on emails, right, for communication versus in-person conversation a lot of times when you're not in the same office. So, you know, what I think really has to happen, when you're getting, say you're in accounting, right, and you're getting that email request to transfer funds, you know, $1 million to your new bank, right, which could be a hacker, right, behind that whole email. You know, you want to have a callback provision where somebody picks up a phone and says, hey, did you request me to send that $1 million, right? So just very basic processes, procedures that can prevent a social engineering attack or a funds transfer scheme really need to be put in place. So that's sort of important. And of course, you know, on the technology side, you know, bring your own device policies, right? Do you have one? Do you have one in place? Do you allow people to use their own device? And do you have technical controls in place to make sure it's secure when someone accesses corporate data via their phone or some other mobile device? So really, really important there on the technical side as well.
Yeah, sure. That makes sense. And, you know, one thing I found really interesting about the report is that, you know, it said only 5% of organizations surveyed said they feel very confident that cyber incidents involving the remote workforce will be covered by insurance. So from your perspective, why is there such a lack of confidence in insurance coverage? And, you know, what coverage gaps exist, particularly around these, you know, social engineering related risks?
Well, there's a number of reasons for that. I think, you know, first of all, I mean, when you talk about cyber insurance policy, standalone cyber insurance policies, these are policies that are written on manuscript forms, meaning that the insurance carrier can write their own terms and conditions and change those terms and conditions year after year. And as the threats evolve, as claims, incur, they may want to limit coverage in a way, right? And so you're dealing with a lot of that right now. We're dealing with a hard insurance market. We're seeing that carriers are paying a lot more cyber claims than they ever did before. And they're starting to maybe change coverage, pull some of that back. So they may say that if you have a ransomware attack, we're not going to give you full limits. We're going to give you half of the limit. That kind of change happens with your incumbent carrier. And then you say, all right, let me see what the market's doing. And the other markets, the other competitors of your incumbent carrier are doing similar things. So the entire market is changing, right? It's sort of evolving along with the threats, along with the increased claims, and the terms and conditions change. So it's sort of a difficult insurance market to navigate. And unless you have a cyber broker who's focused on it all day, every day, as we are, you might not realize that there's coverage changes that are going to impact you. There's going to be less coverage, perhaps, or terms are changed, and you may have no coverage. So I understand from the insurance buyer's perspective, there are challenges, but if you have experts that are focused all day, every day, like we are, who are constantly communicating with leading insurance carriers, we kind of have that knowledge ahead of time and do our best to relay that and make sure that our experts are prepared for it and that they're understanding what they're getting. So it's a bit of a challenge in that, there is constant change and there are so many carriers writing cyber coverage. There's probably 100 to 200 carriers right now writing some form of cyber insurance coverage, and it could change from policy to policy.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. And kind of going along with that, what's the best way for insurers to step in to address these coverage challenges and provide some peace of mind for businesses that have employees working remotely?
Well, I think first and foremost, you've got to communicate, right? And you've got to communicate early in the renewal process. So, what maybe used to be a three-month renewal cycle where we sort of get in front of the client, get information from the carrier, there's a lot more information that may need to be shared and understood. So you really got to spend a lot more time on it, right? There are a lot more questions on controls that the underwriter has of the client. And we have to help sort of facilitate that whole process. If you're going to change coverage, be out in front and articulate that and do it early and make sure that our client knows that if they're not happy with that, they can go to the other markets, but we'll have to sort through all of those changes as well. So timing is critical when it comes to this. And sort of getting out in front of all the changes and communicating them, in plain English, right? And trying to translate all that for the buyer is really critical. You can understand, it's been a rough go of it for some of these carriers, right? They've lost money, some of them, in that, they're paying, limits out on ransomware claims. So this is, they're taking a harder look at it, and they're pulling back coverage where they see fit, and they're not renewing some of these policies where they deem that the particular risk is not, up to what, doesn't have the controls that they think they should have. So it's sort of a tough go, but I think, if you plan accordingly, plan in advance, give yourself enough time to communicate effectively, you'll be in a much better place.
Right. Yeah, that's great advice. Well, John, this has been a great conversation. So thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
All right. Thank you very much.
That's all for this episode. Thanks to Aaron and John for taking the time to speak with me. And thanks to everyone who tuned in. Once again, my name's Elizabeth Blossfield, and I'm the host of the Insuring Cyber Podcast, a bi-monthly look into how the world of cyber and the business of insurance are connected. Be sure to check back for new episodes every other Wednesday, and thanks for listening.